Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sarah Lipton Lubitt of the American Civil Liberties Union, who examines a recently passed bill in the GOP-controlled House that would allow hospitals to deny life-saving care to women in need of emergency abortion services. Jeff Smith, an Occupy Wall Street activist, who talks about the rapidly expanding global economic justice movement and how it may relate to U.S. electoral politics. And Ellen Brown, president of the Public Banking Institute, who explains why she believes North Dakota's public banking system could become a model for an alternative to the U.S. for-profit financial system nationwide. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The nation of Myanmar recently released 300 political prisoners in what government officials say is an amnesty that will free a total 6,300 detainees. The move is part of an effort by Myanmar's new civilian-led government to improve ties with the United States and other Western governments, which have imposed economic sanctions against the repressive Southeast Asian country. Among those released was comedian and activist Zar Ganar, who was arrested in 2008 for criticizing the slow government response to Cyclone Nargis, which killed over 140,000 people in Burma. Amnesty International researcher Benjamin Zawaki called the prisoner release disappointing since 1,800 political prisoners remained behind bars. Myanmar's civilian president, Thein Sein, a former general, recently initiated a dialogue with long-imprisoned pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Yet many Burmese exiles are skeptical about the military regime's path to reform. Free Burma Coalition founder Zar Nie told the Los Angeles Times, "We are not fooling ourselves that this regime is driven by reformers." A single tax change dating back to the 1990s known as Check the Box now costs American taxpayers over $10 billion a year. The tax rule allows U.S. corporations to transfer their profits from high-tax countries by simply declaring subsidiaries as a disregarded entity. By marking this box, a big multinational corporation can avoid the 35% U.S. corporate tax rate on certain types of income. The tax rule has also fueled a surge in foreign investment by U.S.-based multinationals. According to ProPublica, Congress and the Obama administration have tried to close the check-the-box loophole, but faced intense resistance from corporate America, even at a time when Europe and Japan are tightening corporate tax laws. Critics call check-the-box a form of tax arbitrage, the art of exploiting differences in tax systems in various countries. The tax rule has also proven immune from calls for tax reform. President Obama tried to get rid of Check the Box when he first took office in 2009. It was top on his list of tax reforms. Corporate lobbyists called the proposal ridiculous, and groups like the Business Roundtable, Chamber of Commerce, and the National Foreign Trade Council fought hard to protect the corporate tax loophole. In early 2010, the Obama White House backed off and let Check the Box stand. In the world of emergency humanitarian relief, Plumpy Nut is the state-of-the-art in fighting severe malnutrition. Plumpy Nut is a peanut butter-like paste packed with nutrients that can easily be fed to children in famine conditions. Over the last decade, the product has changed the nature of emergency relief so operations are less dependent on NGO doctors and hospitals. But now there is a shortage of Plumpy Nut. Currently, only 5-10% of malnourished children can get Plumpy Nut, and there is limited international funding to produce it. Production of Plumpy Nut is tightly controlled by French company Nutricet that owns the patent and tightly controls production licenses in the U.S. and Europe. The company currently bans large-scale production of the peanut-like paste in favor of local production in poor countries like Niger and Malawi, where poor infrastructure limits the quantities that can be made. Critics of Nutricet, including Doctors Without Borders, say initiatives to promote development in poor countries should not take priority over the needs of hungry people in the grip of a famine, such as in Somalia. The power of the patent was seen when Nutricet recently relaxed the Plumpy Nut patent in Kenya in order to boost production and relieve the spreading hunger crisis in the Horn of Africa. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The U.S. House of Representatives just passed another in a series of anti-abortion bills that has been characterized by women's and civil liberties groups as one of the most extreme yet from the Republican-controlled body. The measure would allow hospitals to deny life-saving care to women in need of emergency abortion services. It would also deny women insurance coverage for abortion services under the new health care system, taking away insurance coverage that millions of women already have. According to the American Journal of Public Health, Catholic hospitals already have a history of ignoring their obligation to provide emergency care that may involve performing abortions. In 1979, an Arizona bishop excommunicated a nun who authorized an abortion procedure for a woman who otherwise might have died of pulmonary hypertension at a Catholic hospital in Phoenix. The main sponsor of the bill was Republican Congressman Joe Pitts from Pennsylvania, who was a co-sponsor of anti-abortion legislation known as the Stupak-Pitts Amendment to President Obama's health care reform legislation. Pitts' bill, H.R. 358, the Protect Life Act, passed in the House by a large majority, 251 to 172, and now goes to the Senate. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Sarah Lipton Lubit, policy counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union. She describes what the bill would do and explains why the ACLU is involved in opposing the measure.
It's one in a line of anti-choice measures that the anti-choice leadership of the House has been pushing in really an unrelenting fashion this year. But this bill in particular is both unprecedented and unconscionable. It literally puts women's lives on the line in a way that we haven't seen before.
What are some examples of what would happen if this bill were to pass?
Current law requires that patients in medical emergencies receive appropriate medical treatment, which includes abortion care, if that's what is medically indicated for them. And this bill, the so-called Protect Life Act, although it actually threatens women's lives, would allow a hospital to ignore those essential emergency protections. So that means that a woman could show up in a hospital mid-emergency, right, her health and or her life under serious threat. The care that she needs is an emergency termination of her pregnancy. Her treating physician knows that's the care that she needs, wants to provide that care for her, and the hospital could say no.
Is this different from what Catholic hospitals do now?
This bill is designed to give license to those practices, which are currently not permitted.
And what do you think its chances are in the Senate?
We certainly hope that outrageous legislation like this wouldn't get a minute of time in the Senate. But it shouldn't have come to the House floor in the first place. It's insulting to women and to their families, and it would be almost unbelievable if the threat to women weren't so real.
Has Obama spoken out on this yet? I imagine he would veto it if it got to his desk.
The administration issued a veto threat.
Sarah Lipton Lubet, I first heard about this bill not from my usual sources like NARAL Pro-Choice America or the National Organization for Women or Planned Parenthood, but from the ACLU. How does abortion fit into ACLU's mission?
For decades, the ACLU has been centrally involved in the pro-choice movement. We've been involved in litigation in almost every case having to do with reproductive rights that's come before the Supreme Court, and we're actively involved in D.C. trying to protect the right to privacy that protects women's access to abortion care. And in particular, when it comes to institutions refusing to provide appropriate medical care or information on religious grounds. You know, about a year ago, you may recall the story of a woman in Arizona, a mother of several children, who had a life-threatening condition, was at a Catholicly affiliated hospital. The ethics board there permitted her to have the abortion care that she needed to protect her life. And as a result of that, the staff that signed that approval was demoted, and the hospital lost its Catholic status. Well, that was a story that got some national attention, and in the wake of that, the ACLU reached out to the Department of Health and Human Services to file a complaint and say, you know, Department of Health and Human Services, you need to make sure that hospitals are informed of their obligations under emergency care laws, such as the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act. You need to make sure that hospitals are following these protections and giving women the care that they need.
There's another major problem with this legislation regarding insurance coverage for abortion. It seems like it's the reappearance of the infamous Stupak Amendment that was defeated before Obama's health care reform passed.
In addition to creating this dangerous loophole in emergency protection laws, this bill would effectively eliminate insurance coverage for abortion in plans sold on the new marketplaces created by health care reform. Most private insurance plans already cover abortion care. It's the standard of care. And this would result in depriving millions of women of the coverage that they already have.
That was Sarah Lipton-Lubit, policy counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union. For more information on pending anti-abortion legislation, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As the activists in New York City's Zuccotti Park were gearing up to celebrate the one-month anniversary of their Occupy Wall Street encampment, the ripple effects of what started out as a modest protest of several hundred people was blossoming into what is increasingly being recognized as a powerful worldwide movement. A global day of protest in solidarity with the Occupy Wall Street action on October 15th saw thousands of demonstrators gather in New York City's Times Square and other cities large and small across the U.S. and around the world that included Chicago, Los Angeles, Miami, Toronto, London, Berlin, Tokyo, and Sydney. The demonstrations against corporate greed and the widening gap between the rich and poor were mostly peaceful, with the exception of clashes between police and a small group of combative protesters in Rome. While it's not surprising that liberal intellectuals and Hollywood actors have expressed support for the Occupy Wall Street protests, one measure of the new movement's power is the rhetorical retreat by at least one Republican leader in the past few weeks. Although House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, Republican of Virginia, has repeatedly branded the Occupy Wall Street activists as angry mobs, in an October 16th television appearance on Fox News Sunday, the lawmaker toned down his rhetoric when he agreed with the protesters that too few people control too much wealth in America. Your reporter visited the New York protest site and spoke with Jeff Smith, an Occupy Wall Street activist who has been at Zuccotti Park from the first day of the encampment on September 17th. He talks about the rapidly expanding economic justice movement and how it may relate to U.S. electoral politics.
Well, I think, you know, in America, there's so much pain that's been percolating just under the surface. And what I think this movement was able to do is gain some traction and basically is a catalyst for, you know, so much emotion that's been ready to come out. And so really the hardest part, at least in this country, is getting that foothold, getting the start of something that people will pay attention to and that other people want to come together around. And so the strategy in making this a permanent occupation and essentially not going away or telling the media and the public we're not going away was the first step in creating that traction. And although plenty of the media ignored us to begin with, and subsequent to that they started to belittle us and mock us, and the coverage has definitely changed. At this point now, as it's grown in popularity, we're starting to get some real coverage, and it grows even more. But I think all along the public understood exactly what this is about. And when we say it's Occupy Wall Street, it's about the financial power in this country and the fact that even more so than Washington, D.C., this is where decisions are made in this country.
As far as the corporate media focus, almost their sole focus for many weeks now has been, where's your list of demands? Where's your clarity? Where's a convenient slogan that we can pigeonhole you guys as to what you're about? I wonder if you would tell us, what's your impression of the pros and cons of what looks to be building a grassroots movement from the bottom up as opposed to some hierarchical structure where some, you know, activists in a back office hand down a list of demands to everybody else? What are the pros and cons with that, you think?
Well, I think in a lot of cases, you know, what may be described as our weaknesses and our strengths are really the same. And so by not having a hierarchical structure and specific messaging and a list of demands, the corporate media doesn't know how to cover this or approach it. And we know that if we gave them a list, who would acknowledge it anyway? I mean, they just want that so that they can tear us down, and that's understood. So rather than playing their game, I think we maintain a sort of transparency and, you know, anti-strategy when it comes to messaging that goes straight through to the public, and I think that's why it's effective. And I think everything that we're doing here is about representing. I mean, Gandhi says that the means are parallel to the end. So really what we're establishing here in every way, I think, mirrors the society as we'd like to see it change. And the fact that the corporate media can't cover that story or can't understand that is sort of indicative of the fact that all of our hierarchical structures no longer represent the vast public. And so when people come here and they experience this firsthand, I think they get it immediately, and it resonates in a way that is both obtuse to the corporate media, but also, you know, goes around them in a way that is finally feeling like the truth is winning out over, you know, messaging and propaganda. And usually it's not even about who's right or who's got the best facts. It's about who positions the message the best, and that's who wins. And I think it's really edifying to this movement, the fact that the truth does seem to be, you know, winning out, and the public does seem to get this.
Just the last question. When a lot of flawed comparisons are made to the Tea Party about what's going on here in Zuccotti right. Park and across the country, there's some focus on electoral politics and what this is going to mean, you know, in terms of the next election, which is an important election.
Right.
What do you see the impact of this Occupy Wall Street movement on electoral politics in terms of, you know, changing the subject, changing the topic of debate and the direction of the debate, or something more tangible in terms of pressuring candidates to do X, Y, Z?
I mean, it's been described that this is sort of the answer to the Tea Party on the left. I think it's probably more appropriate. I think Naomi Klein that said that it's really, this is the answer to the Democratic Party. And I think there's no misgivings that both corporate parties are really on the outside of what's going on here, which is not to say that there aren't people here that may vote for Obama as opposed to the candidate. And I don't know that we can pretend to say that this is going to change politics within the next election cycle. But I think that it's completely off message to say that we want to channel this towards any specific electoral party. I think that's been done in the past, and frankly, that's the failings of other grassroots efforts, is that by the time you channel it into the status quo, they can control it and take it over. And part of what's great about this is that no one can take over this. And even when it's been talk about Democratic groups or union groups or any kind of hierarchical structures wanting to co-opt this, the fundamental nature of this structure doesn't allow for it. And so I think ultimately this is about replacing the current system of electoral politics with something that actually works. And I think it's sort of pointless to talk about, you know, its effects on the existing structure.
That was Jeff Smith, an Occupy Wall Street activist who has been at Zuccotti Park from the first day of the encampment on September 17th. Find more links to analysis and commentary on the Occupy Wall Street movement on our website at btlonline.org. Growing public support for the Occupy Wall Street protest movement speaks to the long simmering anger and frustration with the failures of the current economic system and the lack of accountability for the bankers and financiers whose reckless behavior wrecked the U.S. and world economy. In the U.S., recent polls find majority support for the protesters' central message condemning corporate greed and the corrupt political system rigged in favor of the interests of America's wealthiest 1%. While the U.S. corporate media is angry that it cannot yet get a specific list of the Occupy Wall Street activists' demands for change, there are many ideas for restructuring the U.S. financial and banking system that have been circulating for years that could offer viable solutions to repairing a broken system. Just as there was majority support to establish a public nonprofit alternative to private for-profit health insurance in the recent national healthcare reform debate, there is growing support for a government bank that offers competition to the nation's largest private banks that recklessly engaged in casino-like gambling and lost billions of dollars in their customers' investments. The public banking idea comes from the successful example of the 92-year-old Bank of North Dakota, the nation's only statewide publicly owned bank. Some observers credit North Dakota's public banking system for the state's low unemployment rate and large budget surpluses during the recent Great Recession. Your reporter spoke with Ellen Brown, an attorney and president of the Institute for Public Banking. Here she explains how North Dakota's public banking system works and how a similar system could be adopted by states nationwide.
North Dakota, our single public bank, was set up in 1919 under conditions quite like what we have today, where the farmers were losing their farms to the Wall Street bankers. And when they discovered that the Wall Street banks were hooked to the railroads, were hooked to the granaries, so it was all one cartel. It was a Rockefeller cartel at that time. And they weren't actually taking their grain when it was good grain. So there was actually an effort to get these farms. And when they realized that, they banded together and formed a party called the Nonpartisan League. It was not about politics. It was not about socialism. In fact, North Dakota is a very Republican, conservative state. It was about state sovereignty, keeping their money in the state to serve their people. So the Bank of North Dakota was set up to basically do what the Federal Reserve does. It was sort of a central bank for the system. So it provides the liquidity for the little banks. It helps them with their capital requirements. It does not compete with the local banks. It partners with them. So they didn't get into this whole derivative mortgage-backed security type scheme because they didn't need to, because they had the backstop of the Bank of North Dakota. So they tend to keep the loans on their own books. And so these are local people. They follow them to make sure that they can pay. And it's a real partnership with the local economy and not one that's designed to exploit the local economy. So right now we have bills pending in 14 different states, either to form a state-owned bank or to do a feasibility study to see, you know, what it could do for the state.
Ellen, how would instituting a North Dakota-style public banking system in states around the country, how would that address many of the complaints and the resulting shattered economy we've seen from the reckless behavior of the for-profit banks?
Well, the number one thing it would do is to create jobs. The reason jobs are largely come through the small and medium-sized businesses, those same businesses that are funded by the public banks in Germany, and which is why they have such a strong manufacturing sector and export sector. It's the small and medium-sized local businesses that are not able to hire because they no longer have customers, and they don't have customers because the collapse of the mortgage situation and the whole credit collapse. And they can't get loans. They can't get cheap credit like they used to. In California, I've heard complaints. They used to be able to get 8% credit lines at their bank. And nothing has changed in their business. But suddenly, the banks are requiring them to use credit cards. So that's 16%. That doubles their interest rate. And all small companies run on credit, or even large companies, but they don't have trouble getting credit. But the small companies, you have to pay your workers and materials before you have a product. So if you can't get that credit line, then you don't dare expand your business and you don't dare hire more people. And a public banking setup will allow that. As in North Dakota, the Bank of North Dakota partners with the local banks, and therefore they have lots of liquidity so they can make these local loans.
How much subsidies go to the North Dakota Bank from taxpayers?
No, the subsidies goes from the Bank of North Dakota to the taxpayers. Their profits go back to the state. Actually, they had a 19% return last year, I think. And before that, they had like a 26% return. They have a huge return on equity, and this is a major source of profits for the state. But the bank is not subsidized at all. I mean, how this bank works is that all of the state's revenues are deposited in the bank, but it is set up as a DBA of the state. So technically, all of the capital belongs to the bank as well. So it has no capital requirements. It has no deposit requirements. so then what it does with this huge amount of liquidity that it has is to spread it around and share it with the other banks.
Ellen, if you were to recommend a course of action state by state or on the federal level to institute public banking to provide funding for small businesses as an engine for the economy to boost employment and the economy as a whole, how would you go about it?
Well, I don't know that you do it on the federal level. And in fact, the reason we like the state-owned banks is that the federal level is pretty well locked up. They're deadlocked. They can't seem to make much progress in anything. But at the state level, you can still get in to see your legislators and they'll listen to you. Here in California, we have a state bank bill that it just passed both houses of the legislature. Now, it wasn't signed by the governor, unfortunately, but there's still good momentum for our state bank movement. And not just us. I mean, we're just volunteers on the ground who just generated interest and kept pushing until something happened here. And it really is a state thing. I mean, it's totally legal. Anybody can set up a bank who can qualify with the banking commissioner. I mean, Walmart could set up a bank if they wanted to. So there's no reason a state can't set up a bank. And it's just a matter of understanding what the principle here is. Banks actually literally create money. That's where our money comes from. They create money by leveraging their capital, and then they clear it through the deposits. So that power, the power to create bank credit, is what we want to get back into our local communities using our own local assets. We don't want to be giving away our capital and our revenues to Wall Street to use that leveraging power to be speculating abroad, speculating against us, buying up foreign companies that might compete with our companies, et cetera, all the things that Wall Street does, purporting to be doing it with their own money so, you know, they can do whatever they want. But they're not doing it with their own money. They're doing it with our money. So we want to bring our money back and use it for local purposes.
That was Ellen Brown, an attorney and president of the Institute for Public Banking. Her latest book is titled Web of Debt, The Shocking Truth About Our Money System and How We Can Break Free. Read more about the benefits of public banking on our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut, 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.